Thank you. Hello. Hope you can hear me. I've got various mics. I can't hear either of them. But do wave if you can't hear me at the back. So embracing love. So experiencing love is one of the great delights of being human, isn't it? I would say. And whether it's romance or family love or close friendship or even love of the sacred, whatever it is, it enlarges us, it broadens us, doesn't it? And the Buddha certainly urged us to cultivate all the different facets of love, or the healthy ones anyway. So that would be empathy, enthusiasm, contentment, tranquility, ardency, patience, rapture, peace, compassion, faith, and particularly loving kindness. And all of these, in their different ways, they kind of bring us to greater maturity, and they bring us to a sense of being capable of enjoying the present, living in the present happily. So for most Buddhists, I would say that loving kindness is the key one. And but I really love the word love. It has a real power, doesn't it? Something very primal, if you like. But I'm going to use the word metta because it's more precise. And love, as we know, has so many different associations, some of them very positive, some of them a bit sentimental or twisted or possessive. And with metta, we mean something very wholesome, something very clean goodwill to all beings, you know, not sticky sort of love. So metta is the heart's expression of selflessness. That's one way you could put it, I think. So it brings us an understanding of what matters deeply in life, perhaps most deeply in life. And it might sometimes feel counterintuitive to move towards someone that we're reacting to or find scary or whatever. But actually, it's going with the grain of the mind. It's going with how human beings are at root. So yes, we hear there's greed and hatred and confusion and so on, but underneath that we're relational beings. Underneath that we're connected. So love is actually going with the grain of what it is to be human. It's the natural human state, you could say, before we add all our layers of trickiness on top. So the nature of mind is that it's always moving. So staying still is not an option. Sometimes that's what we belong for, but it isn't an option. So in a sense, it's our choice. What do we move towards? Do we move towards connection or contraction? Love or aversion? It's our choice, really. It's our choice any minute, isn't it? So as the recent conflicts and floods around the world make evident to us, the world is a very uncertain place. Outwardly and inwardly, internally, is also pretty unstable for most of us. But through metta, we develop a lot more stability. And we even can develop the skill that Sangharakshita, the Triratna teacher, puts it. He says, learning to bear having no bearings. Which is, you know, sounds easy to say, but to bear having no bearings is really quite a tall order. And metta really helps us to move towards that place. So with metta we become strong, we become pliable, we become able to deal with whatever life throws at us, at least with the confidence that it won't overwhelm us. I'm not saying it won't be difficult, but somehow we can move towards it nonetheless. And in a way you could say it's the only wise response to difficulties, to fear or pain or whatever it is, because all the other responses, like denial or distracting ourselves or resistance, they're all dead ends basically. Compassion and metta are the only sensible response to those sorts of difficulties. So loving kindness is often referred to or thought of as a feeling, but it's much, much more than that. It isn't just a feeling. It's a mix of mind, body, heart, spirit, head, everything. It's a mixture of intention, emotion and reason, all of them together. And it also includes body sensation, it includes willpower and imagination. There's the whole gamut, really, all included in this thing called metta, not just a feeling. It's an attitude. Sometimes it's called an orientation. So without metta as this integration of all these things I've been saying, we're much more at the mercy of fluctuating feelings, much more likely to be toppled, as it were. So with metta we can experience loss without tipping into despair. We can experience criticism without getting into hating ourselves. We can experience happiness without grasping at it. And we can experience love without getting obsessed on a good day. So it just has this very stabilizing effect. I heard about a seminar in which the Dalai Lama was giving a commentary on a text. And as the translator was translating, the Dalai Lama interrupted him and said, "No, no, that isn't what I said." And the translator went, "Well, yes, it is, Your Holiness." And he said, "No, no, it wasn't." And he said, "Yes, it was." So they had a little banter. And eventually they moved into Tibetan. And then they he found the bit in the text, the disputed part. And the Dalai Lama read it. And then he burst out laughing and went, "Ho, ho, ho, I made a mistake." And just laughed uproariously. And there was 1,200 people sitting there watching him fall into a pit, as it were. And there was just something so wonderful about that. You know, so many of us would have gone into sort of shame or embarrassment or some sort of trying to deny that, you know, I meant another part or something. But yeah, there's some real example of that unconstricted heart where he doesn't have any image of himself to protect or anything. He's just able to be himself. "Oh, well, I made an error," with honesty in a way, and metta. So I thought that was a really lovely story. As far as we know, the Buddha wasn't actually taught metta by either of his meditation teachers. It was actually the natural fruit of his own meditations and insights and so on. And it seems that at first he didn't teach it, or at least various scholars seem to have concluded that. They think that the primary source for metta, for those of you interested in this level of detail, the Metta Sutta, wasn't taught for the first 10 years after he was enlightened. And I was thinking about this and thinking, well, perhaps he just thought that his followers would get it, that it's so obviously necessary. And after a bit he realised, well, I probably need to spell this out, actually, loving kindness and all the other positive emotions. I found that quite telling, actually, that he wasn't taught it. And apparently when he did teach it, it was first as an antidote to fear, which I can very much relate to. It definitely erodes fear. And it boosts or bolsters our self-confidence and self-reliance. So we can still be metaful if we're not feeling good or upbeat. It's much more about how we relate to our stuff, whatever's going on, if we can relate kindly to it. Can we be kind to our grumpiness? Sort of yes in principle, but can you actually when you're feeling grumpy? So if I see metta as a sort of steady connectedness to other people, it's not about trying to squeeze out love from somewhere, which, you know, sometimes works, but sometimes feels not very doable at all. It's more of a recognition. It's more of a recognition that we are loving beings, if only we knew it and stopped getting in our own way. Recently, I've also been doing something I call the kindfulness of breathing, which is a kind of mix of those two practices, the loving-kindness and the mindfulness practice. And it brings more warmth to the breath practice and more allowing somehow, and yet some sense of focus and gathering in to the metta practice. So I really like that, the kindfulness of breathing. Another thing that's very much helped my metta meditations has been discovering that the word bhavana, which means cultivation, that actually has two aspects. So one of the aspects is about cultivating, as most of us know, and the other aspect is about being receptive to what we're actually experiencing here and now. And I didn't know that traditionally that was what the word means. And I find that really heartening, because it's not about this squeezing out or making something happen. We start by recognizing what's there in our experience and give that equal weight to the kind of galvanizing aspect that some of us can find quite difficult at times. So definitely a start where you are, and a recognizing before you do anything. So it's experiencing in both ways, as it were, which I found very helpful. Another thing I find very helpful, which I think comes from the Tibetan tradition, is starting with gratitude. And I do this when I'm teaching locally, which a lot of people have said they find very helpful with blocks to their self-care or self-love. Just reflecting on all the positive things that have come your way, the blessings that have come to you in your life, all the things that you've received, the help and support and love and care. And it's almost like we need to kind of drink that in and imbibe that before moving into any sense of sharing it out, I suppose. And opening up to the love that we have received is very helpful for holding any sense of hurt or wounding that we may have. And it seems really that all of us somewhere, maybe we're not so conscious of it, maybe we've buried it with activity or busyness, but most of us have this sense of unlovedness somewhere under the layers of our being. And if we can just allow that sense of having received, or even receiving in the present, to be part of the mix, it helps us hold any hurt or wounding or any sense of resistance that we have in the present. So I find it very, very, very heartening, really. And gratitude also adds this realistic sense of who we are. Even if we're feeling isolated, that's actually not true. At base, we are relational beings. We're part of a web of connections. So even when we're feeling our worst or our loneliest, actually we are relational beings. And we do receive. So somehow that sort of loosens any kind of tight tangles we can get into. I heard the American teacher Noah Levine give a talk last year. He was on the topic of metta for self. Loving kindness for himself, and he was saying, after many years of Dharma practice, I've boiled it down to one thing that I've learned, and that is basically, I am not my fault. I love that. I am not my fault. You know, all this monkey mind and the egocentricity and the suffering, all of that, it's not my fault. And if we can keep that attitude, I think it's tremendously helpful. I sometimes bring it in when I'm in a mess. I am not my fault. And can we see our own mess, our own tangles, our own unskillfulness, and not throw another arrow at ourselves and criticize and judge and all the rest of it? Kind of lighten up. I like that. I am not my fault. So traditionally there are four dimensions of metta. So there's the loving kindness, there's compassion, which is metta's response to suffering. There's joy at other people's joy, and there's equanimity, which is said to encompass them all in this sort of broad expanse of mellowness. Those are called the Brahma Viharas, as some of you know. And significant to all four of those is empathy. And empathy, I'd say, is the imaginative identification with other people. It's central, as Sally was mentioning, to my work as a non-violent communication trainer. So I sometimes talk about this capacity for empathy as a bit like visiting somebody else, going to inhabit their world for a while, understanding their preoccupations, their concerns, taking in their view, as it were. And I've seen again and again on trainings how empathy is irresistible. I love that. It's irresistible. And I feel it in myself when it's coming my way. It's irresistible and it's transformative. So if we keep a kindly focus, we never need to hear criticism or blame from other people again. They might abuse us or something, but we don't need to hear it that way. It's really them talking about themselves, a plea from themselves, if you like. And empathy is what gives me the confidence to walk into a conflict and mediate, which is one of the things I do these days, without being too scared. And what enables that for me is three things. There's firstly staying present. Secondly is listening without judgment, which of course is a task in itself. And imagination, as I've mentioned again. We need the imagination to take us out beyond our own sphere, as it were. The other thing about empathy is it creates a certain climate in the room, as it were. It creates the climate whereby more awareness comes to the speaker. So if I'm empathizing with you, or whoever it is, more awareness comes to the speaker, more emerges into their consciousness. So it's a wonderful gift. And of course it works both ways. It's mutually beneficial because it's a stretch for me, if it was me, or whoever it is, you know. So it's a mutually beneficial experience. It asks me to empty my mind and step beyond my self-concerns to meet you. So the Buddha observed that our minds habitually see separation and otherness. Here's me, there's you. But empathy bridges that divide. So we don't need to know the details about someone's life. We don't even need to agree with them. That, in a way, isn't the point. But we just need to be present and imagine intensely. Imagine more. Keep going. Intensify. And I think also empathy is naturally respectful. If we really see another person, in seeing them we give life. That's one of the things that's happening. Our attention brings energy. And I feel respected if I'm seen for who I am. That's another thing that happens. So careful attention changes not only the receiver but the giver. It's mutual, as I was saying. And it's the same with listening. Not just seeing, but listening. Listening to others is intrinsically kind, I would say. It requires us to go beyond ourselves. And if we listen fully, we're already a bit freer. Just a little bit freer from our own self-preoccupation. Everybody longs to be heard. This comes up again and again and again in workshops I lead. They long to be heard. Often that's the prime thing that people want, which is quite sobering in a way. But I can only listen if I silence the voices within me that keep me separated from you. We can also be listening beneath the surface to the deeper things in people's experience, their longings, their dreams, their values. And also the things they don't say. Listening to the quality of the silence. There's a TV drama called Garrow's Law, which some of you may have seen. It's about an ethically upright lawyer from the 18th century. And in one of the cases, this chap, Garrow, he tried, but he didn't succeed to save a 10-year-old boy who was going to be hanged for some really trivial, petty offence. And so it was a rather sad episode, actually. And after the trial, Garrow was really perturbed and bothered that he hadn't won. And he went to the boy's prison cell. I think it was the night before he was going to be hanged, or even sooner than that. And his mother and the little boy were there, and his mother starts shouting at Garrow and being quite abusive. And Garrow bears it very patiently, and he apologizes. And then he said, "But I'll pass the final hour with you here, if I may." And he just sits down in that damp prison cell with these people he hardly knows, actually, and just they sit there in silence, or so it would seem in the drama, for the final hour. And I thought that was really beautiful, actually. There was a real empathy in that. There was nothing really to say after saying he was sorry. But there's something about that alongsideness, willing to participate in another person's pain. There's nothing to make better, you know, but maybe we underestimate sometimes what we can do. You know, maybe there isn't anything to do, but perhaps we can just be alongside with our empathy, with our human kindness, really. According to Karen Armstrong, who's written a book called 12 Steps to Compassion, reaching out generously to embrace the pain of another person yields ecstatic moments. Maybe you've experienced this. Because in such moments, we're free from our egoistic selves, she says, and we expand into altered states of consciousness. And I don't know if you've experienced this, but there is something so freeing about kind of, if you just put down that me stuff and just be there, and actually we feel free. It might not sound like ecstasy in the exciting sense of the word, but there is something. That's what the word officially means. We step beyond ourselves, beyond that contraction. And it is so wonderful in those moments when we do that. Another thing about metta and the Brahma-Viharas is it really helps us to be aware of the mystery that is another human being. We can't pin down other people in the way that we so often think we can, or label them, or think they're this sort of person and that sort of person. But yet, how often when we're not thinking do we slip into that? Thinking we know somebody, thinking we can predict them. Can we just let a friend surprise us? Allow people to be who we are, who they are, and respect the mystery of someone that we can't ever really know. We can't ever really know ourselves that well in all our heights and depths, let alone another person. So something about respecting the mystery, I think, is been important for me to hang on to. So when in the scriptures, Buddhist scriptures, we hear of King Pasenadi from Kosala, some of you will have heard of him, and he went to meet the Buddha, and he said he was really impressed by the friendliness of the community of the Buddha's disciples. He said, in contrast to the people in his court who were always quarrelling and out for their own advantage. And then he said to the Buddha, my wife and I were talking recently. I'm sure he didn't say it quite like that, but anyway, he said that he and his wife were talking and that they'd admitted to each other that actually, when it boiled down to it, the thing that they were most, thing that was most dear to them was themselves, even more than each other, is me. And the Buddha, the king then said to the Buddha, well, you know, what do we do about that? And the Buddha apparently listened empathically, as he always did, and instead of some lecture about self and other and ego and things, he just said, well, if the thing that's most important to you is yourself, you can reflect that that's the same for everybody else. So you shouldn't harm the person of anybody else because they are very dear to themselves. Kind of rather sweet logic, this. And so rather than that we shouldn't be cherishing ourselves, it's just more that we should move out to cherishing everybody more and more. And that just feels so much more doable to me than thinking, right, I have to do that, that's selfish, self-concern, no. It's just actually broadening it out, sharing it out a bit. Metta also, I think, includes humility. It's part of it, and helps us with the problem of conceit. So if we think we're special or better than anybody else, that very much erodes metta. The writer Iris Murdoch said, love is the extremely difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. Which is quite a thought, isn't it? The extremely difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. So if we can really deeply understand that we're not special, which sounds so easy, but actually really difficult, then we do become truly human. That's where we find our own uniqueness, paradoxically. If we stop with thinking we're special, we start to move into something that's genuinely ourselves, genuinely unique. And I think humility lets us learn, doesn't it? We become more genuine. And it's a relief just to stop trying to prove we're acceptable or better than anyone else or tra-la-la. Just to let go of that. Just be ourselves. So easily said. So on the topic of embracing love, I thought I'd like to bring in passion. The Buddha was described as araga, which means free of passion. And I was wondering, well, what on earth does this mean? These days I think passion, as well as sex, associated with sex, it's also associated with things like aliveness, intensity, perhaps even inspiration. So in that sense, free of passion doesn't particularly appeal to me. It sounds almost like something that's a bit subdued or even bland or dull or something. And certainly I'm not very interested in that. But Buddhism's quite particular about what it means about passion. It refers to those compulsive drives that so often lead to suffering, that are rooted in craving and grasping and something tight. Usually things like lust for sex, power, money, and other things I'm sure that you could think of. But it's really about the suffering that these so often lead to. They don't always lead to it. We may get away with it, but you'd have to examine that in your own experience to see if that's true. But by the way, there was nothing emotionally bland about the Buddha, just before we carry on with our passion. He was very potent, energetic, supremely confident. So, yeah, I don't think you'd ever call him a bland person. But, yeah, I wanted to distinguish between sort of healthy passion, if you like, the vitality and intensity that so many of us want to be in touch with, and blind passion, I'm calling it. You know, the sort of passion that contracts and sours experience. So I want to live, and I'm sure we all do, want to live as vividly as we can, in touch with my values, with my longings. So that's hopefully an aware type of compassion. And when I can't manage that, which of course I can't from time to time, without distorting and doing that souring of things, then to look for compassion. So first of all, finding that passion, and when I kind of trip myself up, then having compassion for myself and also for other people who are doing exactly the same, tripping themselves up, souring it, contracting it, whatever we do. One of my teachers, Robert Gonzalez, likens this life energy, these feelings and yearnings and longings that flow through and motivate us. He says it's a bit like a garden hose. There's energy always available, always flowing. It's on tap, actually. Sometimes we don't realize it is. So it's like this water flowing through a garden hose. And when we're present, when we're wholehearted, and when we're passionate, that just flows uninterrupted, if you like. But sadly, what we so often do is we kink the hose. It's so easy to do. It's not a big movement, just a little twist. And then what happens? Just a trickle, if you're lucky, or nothing. The reason I like this image is it's quite easy to undo. Sometimes we think, oh God, I've got in such a tangle that there's no undoing it. But with the garden hose image, actually, it's quite easy to undo. We have to notice, obviously. So when does this happen? This happens when we disconnect from ourselves. So we're enjoying the experience, and then we suddenly go, oh, I want a bit more, or, you know, I want to repeat that, or just make it even better. And then the tightening happens. So that would be the craving version, or, you know, there's a range of other ways in which we distort our kind of passionate energies, ill wills and jealousies and doubts, and I'm sure you've all got plenty of options here for how we distort. But even when this happens, all is not lost if we can bring compassion to ourselves at that point. Bringing compassion can unkink that hose. So we will disrupt the flow, and in a way, let's not expect that we won't. But how can we twist it back? How can we bring compassion? And this sounds also easy to do, and the words are so nicely close to each other. Passion, and if not, well, compassion. And yet, you know, if it's something you feel really ashamed about or something, it's not easy to do. As I was writing this talk, there was something I was feeling really grisly about, something I'd said. And I kind of thought, oh, I must apply that garden hose metaphor. And actually, well, it's all very well, but it isn't very easy to do in the moment. You really have to work at how do you genuinely bring compassion and sit in it, not just think about doing it as a good idea. You have to do the work, really. But it's doable. So, yeah. And if we are compassionate to ourselves, forgetting in a tangle, we soften. And that returns us to the love mode, doesn't it? So we open to the passion, and when we don't manage, can we bring compassion? I thought I'd like to mention falling in love at this point. This could be another whole talk, or indeed another whole festival. And as we know, countless volumes have been devoted to this topic. And today's topic is really universal loving kindness, which isn't the same. But it is very much part of life, part of the journey for most of us, or many of us anyway. So if romantic love finds fertile ground, if it blossoms, great, let's enjoy it. And it's an enriching gift, isn't it? And as I'm sure most of us know, when we're in love, we love anything, we love everything. You know, there's that fantastic feeling of it expands outwards. It doesn't last that long, that phase, unfortunately, but there is that fantastic, you know, anyone and everything, you know, that sort of overflowing. So yeah, that's great. And sometimes erotic love arises inconveniently, doesn't it? Or maybe someone's not free, or it's unrequited, or whatever. And at that point, it's a real trial. I think it's a real trial. We feel blown about, we might feel heartbroken. But either way, our heart has opened. I think that's the point I'm wanting to bring here. Either way, our heart is opened, it's tenderized, something's happened. And obviously when love's welcome, in terms of metta, in terms of the spiritual life, can we bring loving kindness to the relationship and not just see the other person as our love object, as it were? Can we expand? Can we bring the care and friendliness to see them as an individual in their own right as well? And if the love is unspoken, or it hasn't got an avenue to express itself down, can we still celebrate the love arising? I think this is a real art, without acting on it, if it's unrequited or whatever. Can we recognise that person as simply the occasion on which our heart has opened? They're just the occasion. It's actually about our heart. I think that's a really important point, and it's hard to see that in that moment. Staying clear that they're not the cause of our love. They aren't the cause. The cause lies in our own heart's longing, actually. So it's not really about them, it's about us. And I find this reflection really, really empowering, and it's got me out of a number of holes, I can tell you. So we can ask, well, what is my heart longing for when I fall in love with him or her or whoever, whatever? What is my heart longing for? It may be some quality that I've seen or perhaps I've imagined in the other person. Maybe their wisdom or their imagination or their courage or something else entirely. But if we can focus on that quality that we're longing for, rather than the particular person, we're a lot freer. Whether it's welcome love or unwelcome love, it isn't quite the point here. It's actually about, can we stand in that quality for ourselves? Sometimes we simply love the idea that somebody loves us. I think that happens again and again. Very poignant, really. Again, it's more about ourselves than the other person. Leo Tolstoy wrote about this, and he said, "We do not love people so much for the good that they do us as the good that we can offer them." In the Sangha, in the Buddhist community, people often fall in love with their Dharma teachers, or they idealize them. And again, it's the same principle. It's really our aspirations projected outwards. And the key isn't to judge ourselves for being inappropriate, as I know plenty of my friends have done and felt really bad for having these yearnings and longings. Actually, the yearning for depth or wisdom or whatever it is, passion, is really important. It's really precious. It's our aspiration. We're seeing the beautiful and wanting to move towards it. So how can we hang on to that value without letting it be so entangled with the other person that, you know, that's the only way that we can move towards that beautiful quality? It's our longing. It's our own heart's longing. So it is a hard practice, this, but it is possible to loosen the energy around that and the aspiration from that specific person. So on this topic of longing, I've been very interested in this topic of longing for the last year or so. I've been thinking about willpower and receptivity, those two things that I'm always trying to keep in balance, and yearning, and how they all fit together. And a distinction that really sparked me was between something somebody pointed out, between seeking and longing. Seeking is future orientated. We're kind of moving into the future, and we're not actually accepting who I am in the present. We're kind of wanting something that's not yet happened, as it were. We're seeking something, and it's a function of the thinking mind. Whereas longing is a function of the heart, and it's based in the present. It's present awareness, and it's in a sense a more wholesome yearning for aliveness, perhaps passion, connection, the sacred possibly, whatever that means to you. I really like this clarity. Having seen it, I can really see where I trip myself up. I've done an awful lot of seeking in my life. Well, that's all right. It's got me where I am, and it's, you know, there's a lot of value in it, but there's something more wholesome about longing that keeps me in the heart and keeps me present, I think. In a way, longing has an awareness of or an inkling of something inside that's pushing to be lived, that's wanting to come out. And it reminds me of quite a lot of Sufi poetry. Some of you may know that sort of thing. It's kind of longing for love, the universal love, or the beloved. Perhaps you could say a longing to be who we deeply are, most authentic. So with mindfulness, if I'm noticing, I can shift from that sense of seeking and moving into the future to longing. And it's very satisfying when I do that. There's a kind of mantra in NVC circles that urges us to be fully wanting without attachment, which is a bit of a koan, actually. Really, really wanting whatever it is that you're wanting, but also dropping any attachment to it happening, or when, where, how, or whatever. So we don't give up. We don't say it's not possible, it'll never happen to me, or, you know, any of these other possibilities of going passive. And yet, we're not fixed on outcome of how it will happen. And there's something about that that's very different. It's not agitating. It's very sort of complete in itself, that sort of longing, whereas craving's quite agitated and incomplete and you see, what we yearn for is already in part within us. I think that's what's so empowering, actually. It's in us, at least in miniature, or partly, as it were. Recently I've been longing for healing around a particular health issue, and actually the seeds of healing are there within me. And apparently one of the most helpful things for healing is believing it's possible. So there's that, I can do that, I can believe it's possible. And I can also activate the energy of healing by dwelling on it, dwelling on the quality of it. What's it like? Yes, I've got that sense somewhere, with some sort of abundant thinking, I can activate that quality to some degree, and then unhook from any particular personal healer or method or when or by next Christmas or whatever it is, just unhooking from any particular future orientated aspect, and then somehow we're free. Yeah, so longing dissolves that grip that seeking can have and keeps us in the present. As the poet Rumi says, our task is not to seek for love, but to drop all the barriers within yourself that you have created against it. I'll say that again because I love it. Your task is not to seek for love, but just to drop all the barriers within yourself that you have created against it. So I was thinking, what actually helps us in experience, in practice, to express and receive metta? And first of all, I think we need to know and be known. Sounds very sort of ordinary, if you like, but without it, we're lost, I think. So revealing ourselves honestly to friends and loved ones, is vital. According to the Zen teacher, Norman Fisher, he says, through self-disclosure, we come to realize that we've never been separate somebodies. We've always been brought to life in relationship to somebody else. This has been so every moment of our lives. Which is quite a strong thing to say. Every moment of our lives, that's how we've been brought to life. And he says, even when we're alone. Which is quite something to think about. He says, we're not so much persons as ever-shifting points of meeting. In Mahayana Buddhism, this teaching about the ever-connected nature of the self is emphasized as compassion. So the path of love isn't one option among many. It is the only option. It is the only option. I really love that. Very thought-provoking. So another thing I think that helps with metta is trust. Trust and metta seem to go hand in hand. With trust, we accept that insecurity is part of life and that seeking security is just folly. With trust, we're optimistic. We draw near, don't we? Whereas if we distrust, that separates us, doesn't it, from other people, and it distances us. I was reading recently some studies that show that high trusters aren't necessarily naive, as you might think, but rather they have an intelligence that allows them to assess or distinguish the trustworthy from the less trustworthy. Not having faith, for example, and I mean here things like cynicism or skeptical doubt, that shrinks our view of the world. It also turns into things like muscular tension, and it becomes a hindrance both bodily and emotionally, as well as therefore spiritually. Love is trusting and ready to risk. So metta, comprehensive loving kindness, can be far more intense than I realise, than many of us I think probably realise. The scriptures emphasise three qualities. One, that it's expansive and outgoing, and it also, it finds action, it finds itself expressed in action. It's not, you know, oh, I'll feel kind, but actually I'll go and sit in my armchair. There is momentum, it takes action. It's enduring, it copes with setbacks and trials, and it's resilient, robust. It's also famously said to be freedom of heart. A lovely passage that's often quoted in Buddhist circles is, loving kindness is freedom of heart. It glows, it shines, it blazes forth. Blazes forth. So there's nothing subdued or bland about that, just in case anyone's worried. That sounds passionate to me. I love that image of freedom of heart. Apparently there was a chap called Roja in the scriptures who went to meet the Buddha, and he wasn't very impressed when he met the Buddha. He heard a couple of teachings and went, well, whatever. And he was just leaving, and the Buddha apparently suffused him with a mind of love, whatever that means. He love-bombed him. And Roja turned around and went, and he became a disciple. So I don't know. That was a nice little story. He was dead impressed. This also reminds me of a story I heard about Sangharakshita, Tree Ratna's teacher. It was from many years ago, and a friend of mine asked him, he was kind of worried about how they were getting on or whether his teacher liked him. And he sort of said, I wonder if you've got a low opinion of me, Sangharakshita. And Sangharakshita apparently replied, well, no, I think very highly of you. And And then he continued, he said, but I'm painfully aware that my emotional side often isn't very evident. And then he said, sometimes I'm woken during the night by the power of my metta, which is quite something to say. But I know that, my warmth isn't always so evident. And I found that anecdote very poignant, actually. So metta isn't just all about charm and smiles, actually. Even if you can't see it, someone might be woken in the night by the power of their goodwill towards you. You'll never know, or you might be. Personally, I've been experiencing quite a few ardent metta episodes recently. And I'd like to think it's the fruit of my practice, or maybe it is to some extent, but it's also related to a traumatic event that I had about 5 or 6 years ago. And that brought on insomnia. But curiously, at the same time, it brought an increase of compassion. And I now, it's taken me ages, but I now see that they're connected. Chogyam Trungpa says that wherever we harden or are stuck or resist in fear or whatever it is, that point of vulnerability is paradoxically the bedrock of compassion, the seat of compassion. So vulnerability becomes tenderness, and that becomes the bedrock of life. We awaken to the cries of the world, as it's traditionally put. So in my case, shock held in the body, which most of us have to some extent, it's kept me stuck on a certain level. And it's been a real source of pain and humiliation and all sorts. And at the same time, it's brought these regular releases of metta, sometimes quite strong. So stuckness has definitely brought riches. I certainly now feel more empathic to other people in their stuck places. But I'm also really intrigued by how our limitations, when we really experience them, can turn into strengths. That's a classic thing that comes up in all spiritual paths, I think. But it's very, you know, when it's happening to you, oh my God. Yeah, quite interesting. So many moons ago, months and months ago, I agreed to give this talk on love, because I'm really fascinated by it and I'm often in touch with it. And yet a few weeks ago I was saying to a friend, oh no, right now I could give a talk on handling fear and pain. Don't think anyone would come. But the love side of the coin feels rather distant. And of course she replied, as I know, she said, well, they are not two, they're not so different. And the other side of our pain is our joy. Sort of classic response, which was helpful actually. I'm not being rude to her, but you know, and actually this past week, more or less, love and hope have been slightly trickling back in. So it's just another reminder, I'm laughing at myself now thinking about that. Well, just the need to trust yourself, really. Me, trust that it's there. You just have to do a little bit of garden hose application. Or to take Oscar Wilde's advice, be yourself. Everyone else is taken. I love that. We have to talk about pain and fear. Well, hey, that's what will come out on the day. Or if something else has trickled back in, well, hopefully we can talk about that. So we all know it's easier to be loving and generous when we feel happy and healthy and upbeat and confident. But are we clear about what Buddhism means by positive? Because it's not the same as feeling happy. It's not the same as feeling good. All those are so dependent on things going well, things going our way, which of course they do sometimes and they don't at other times. So our life might feel tough and uphill from time to time, but can we respond positively to that? Can we be kind to ourselves in those situations? Can we be mindful at least? If things are horrible, because we'll all struggle with difficult emotions and so on. So we can remember that I am not my fault, I like that one, and humour and taking myself not so seriously has really punctured some low moments for me. So whatever it is, find your own one. I'm not my fault, or be yourself, everyone else is taken. Whatever it is that just kind of helps you lighten up a bit. even agreeing to have the experience, whatever it is, somehow can shift it a bit. The poet Roger Housden says, I really like this one, he says, the heart, like the grape, is prone to delivering its harvest at the moment it most appears to be crushed. The heart, like the grape, is prone to delivering its harvest in the very moment it most appears to be crushed. So take heart. And if it's someone else we're struggling with, as it may be, someone in our life, we're usually encouraged to be tolerant. Everyone thinks of tolerance as a great thing in the political arena. Tolerance is always being bandied about. And it's widely viewed as a positive quality. And in a way it is. And yet NVC, which I'm very keen on, it says that tolerance falls a bit short. And because it suggests that we view the other person as in some way faulty or deficient, but we tolerate them because we're awfully nice, right? So we think of them as wrong or annoying or something, but a more compassionate attitude wouldn't see them as flawed in the first place. So we speak of tolerating someone or something, a system perhaps, but what we're really tolerating, if we are, is our own reaction to them. So we're willing to stay with the unpleasant feeling that comes up in us when we think of them. So it's really, again, it's all about us. That's what this talk boils down to, isn't it? It's all about me. So if I react to that person, I'm thinking that they're at fault. But if I'm tolerant, I'm willing to bear with the unpleasant feeling and not blame them for it. In other words, I'm taking responsibility for my own mental state. So tolerance is valuable, but a bigger heart wouldn't have reacted in the first place. It wouldn't have judged in the first place. And I think that's quite interesting, actually. What am I actually tolerating? My own negativity. So lastly, the last point I wanted to make was how love leads to insight. I've already mentioned this going beyond self and other, and I'm sure we've all heard that multiple times. According to the Indian master Shantideva, he says there are two vital steps for reducing our self-concern. And that's thinking of ourselves as equal to the other person, no better and no worse, and then actually moving beyond that to exchanging ourselves for other, putting the other person first, seeing them as more important, prioritizing them. So, yeah, we're moving into something that's fairly demanding, but this is how to reverse our habitual self-interest, basically. So to really practice that sense of exchanging self for other takes us to that wisdom that there's no separation, really. It's a false divide. It doesn't exist. The more we really see that basically human beings are one, the easier it is to love other people and just not carry on resisting and emphasizing the divide, the difference, they're so different to me, I can't relate to them, all that stuff. The more we reflect on the Dharma, basically, the more our metta will flower. It's that simple. Often they seem to be put in different categories, but actually it's the same thing. The more we see that we're not different, the more we can love. It's easy to forget that love isn't bound up with things being a certain way or any external conditions, actually. It's not possessible. It's not my metta or your metta. And it certainly isn't dependent on people being nice to us or appreciating us or anything else. We can still love. I've also found reflecting on impermanence really helpful for love. Last year on retreat there was a line that we recited again and again which really went right in, and it was, my life is rushing by like a torrent down a steep mountainside. Doesn't sound very astonishing in a way, but my life is rushing by like a torrent down a steep mountainside. When I was thinking about that, it was incredibly sobering but also very tenderizing. I was just thinking, well, if that's the case, why not love? I mean, what is the point of all this competing and comparing and tra-la-la, you know, actually, forget it. Why react to people? With that perspective, just anything but empathy just seems insane, really. There's so little time. The Buddha and his enlightened followers are evidently motivated by love. It's clear again and again, but they're not shown as ever in need of love. And it's that sort of thing that, can we really get how satisfying it is to love? And it doesn't have to be reciprocal. Often it will be reciprocal, but it's not that sort of bartering, I give you and you give me. It's just the satisfaction of letting the heart express itself. That's what comes out again and again in the scriptures. So in a way, spiritual practice helps to free this innate impulse to love that we all have, so it can become a real strength in our lives. So to conclude, when we open to love, the love that just flows through ordinary human connections, nothing special, it actually can blossom into something quite profound. It takes us beyond that narrow sphere of self-concern and into the experience of interdependence. That's where we actually go with it. Whether we're thinking about it philosophically or not, that is actually where it takes us. So dwelling in that sense of interdependence does call for a revolution of heart. Well, that's in a way what happens when we engage with that. And the whole of life is sustained by that sort of love, if we can remember it. And on a good day, well, we can just drink it in, that love, in a way, of the awakened ones. We can just breathe that in as a blessing. So I'll give the last word to the Buddha. He said that not only are love and compassion the bedrock of Dharma practice, but they're the purpose, the end as well as the means. The reason for my teaching is not for merit, nor for doing good deeds or creating good karma. It's not for concentration, or faith, or bliss, or even insight. None of these. The reason I teach is to ensure the heart's release. Thank you very much.